So why don't you start off telling me your name?
My name is Luther Birch. I'm 90 years of age. I came with my father and mother and the remainder of the family to Spencer in February 1897. We moved from Burlington to Spencer County, my father being employed with the Southern Railroad Spencer Shops. He's formerly employed with Richmond Dandle Railroad.
Your grandfather fairly well-to-do then, or not?
No, he was just a poor tenant farmer. But he had, while he was in Dakotas, he had a frostbite on his right arm. And he made him, disqualified him for full work on the farm. And he got a pension from the federal government, around about $60 a month, which is a pretty good sum back in those days compared to what it is now. I know when I first went to work for a railroad company, I got $25 a month, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
Hmm. What year was that?
That was 1904. I went to work for the Southern Railroad. Southern Railroad was organized in 1894 for Samuel Spencer. Samuel Spencer was a protege of J.P. Morgan, a great financier. Mm-hmm. You used to hear a lot about J.P. Morgan. And very seldom hear his word, his name mentioned now anymore, but he was one of the outstanding financiers of the country. Just before the turn of the century, and well, up until the early part of the 20th century, he was very prominent. But he made him president of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. He served president of the B&O Railroad, and he got him to organize. Richmond Danville Railroad was in bankruptcy, and he sent to Richmond. He acquired the line from Washington to Orange, Virginia. That was the old Orange and Alexander Railroad. Then from Orange to Danville, Virginia, it's called the Virginia Midland Railroad. And the line from Danville to Greensboro was built during the Civil War for the Confederate Army, for the 17th Tennessee Regiment. They built that line from Greensboro to Danville. They got the rails from Atlantic Tennessee and Ohio Railroad, which ran from Charlotte to Taylorsville, North Carolina. And shipped that rail with flat cars to Greensboro and laid the line. He used that track to lay that line because they needed it more for military service than they did for operation of a small railroad.
Mm-hmm.
I had about 20 or 25 pound rail. I don't know what it was in the different gauges of rail. Some museums have the different gauges of rail.
What sort of
first rail the hedge and on down.
What differences would the gauges make?
Well, that's the weight, so many pounds to a foot. And now it's the pounds to the foot was very small what is compared today. It's, I remember when they got up to 90-pound rail, they thought that was enormous in comparison to the, say, 20-pound rail they had, and it got up to be 120-pound rail. They said, oh, we're really going. So I don't know what, it's much heavier than that now. I haven't had any late figures on it, but that rail there now, I'm adding that rail way up around over 200 pounds a foot. I haven't got an expression on because I've been retired now, mm-hmm. 23 years, but didn't keep up the weights of the rail.
Would a heavier gauge allow a heavier railroad?
When Southern Railroaders operated, they had engines, 18, 19-inch cylinders, and began to lay heavy rail, and they got up 20 and 21-inch. Then they went from that to 22-inch rail. And then they even got up to the 30-inch cylinders. They had 22 and 28. That 22-inch cylinders was 500 and 600 class, 700 and 800 class engines. But 22-inch diameter of the cylinder and 28-inch stroke. That is the stroke from the cylinder, length of the cylinder. How it gets the stroke, that's why they got the power. The steam came from into the cylinders, giving the power to get traction to move the freight.
Right. You said you started working for the railroads in 1904, was it?
Yes, September 1904.
How old were you then?
I was 15.
15. Sure. What was your first job?
I was a call boy, calling the engine crews, calling the engineers and firemen. Walk all night long. They ran a lot of trains back in those days, 10 and 12. They finally got about 20 cars. Now they have 200 cars.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big comparison out then. But
so you were a coal boy, is it, or a
call boy?
A call boy.
Yeah, I worked on that about 2 years, and I was promoted to night clerk in the latter part of 1906.
How did you happen to get your job as a call boy?
Well, you have to go out, and when they get the train ready, they have to send the call boy. Now, the yard office, they call the conductor and the two brakemen. When in the roundhouse, they call the engineer and the fireman. They'd have to call them out of beds, you know. Once you leave here at 2:20 this morning, or 3:20 or 4:20, what the hour of the night was. That's where we had electric lights, and you'd have to serve 10 days apprenticeship without any pay to learn the routes where everybody lived. And then you carry a lantern with you. You go in the man's room, first thing you do is you light his lamp. Then you'd wake him up, and he'd sign this call book. That's to indicate that he had been properly informed the time he was supposed to report for duty.
Mm-hmm.
He'd go back to sleep, and after he'd signed that call book, the responsibility would be on him. All I was get his signature on the
right.
call book.
So you finished your job by once you got
after
his signature.
After that, and I'd light his lamp, and he'd get up and go dress, but some of them would be so sleepy they'd go back. They didn't have any 8 hours, or maybe they hadn't been in bed 2 or 3 hours.
Uh-huh.
Well, they had to go back again on the road. That was before they had the Adamson 16-hour law. You couldn't work over 16, and you have to complete your run. You had to have 8 hours rest before you could go back again.
Did they ever get mad at you when you came in and woke them up?
Oh, yeah. They didn't want to fight you almost. Well, you couldn't blame them. You could understand the situation. They just practically exhausted, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and had a big boarding house over in East Spencer called the Red Onion.
The Red Onion?
Yeah. And a lot of them stayed in the Red Onion. And I was walking down the hall there. They had about 30 or 40 rooms, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And some fella had an oil light, and I heard a bang, you know, and a shot fired down and shattered the globe on my lantern. and put out my light, but I knew where the stairway was, and I got out of that. Yeah, there was, man had sufficient sleep and rest, you know, he was ready to go, but those didn't happen to have just about 3 or 4 hours sleep. He was made him kind of mad because he called him so early.
Did he ever actually get into a fist fight with any of them, or?
Oh, no. I was just a chap then. I'd get out of the way. I could outrun him. I was like an antelope. I could outrun most of the boys my age.
But it sounds like you had to do some running a couple times.
Oh, yeah, I had to do some running. And I had a fellow draw a gun on me one time.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, I was calling from his window. He said, get away from there. He didn't want it. Well, he'd been uptown. That was when they had saloons in Salisbury. And I think he was just about half shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't been to bed just about an hour or so. And
he got kind of mad at being woken up,
I kept pecking on the window. He said, get away from me. Reached under his bed, under his pillow, and drew out a gun. Boy, I left, man. I went back and reported to the phone, you know, what he'd done. And there's another man with him. Finally got him out of there, you see. He admitted doing it, but said he wasn't conscious what he was doing. Now, I think, though, they disqualified him for the run because he's intoxicated.
So it wasn't allowable to have...
The representative went back with him to see his condition, you see.
They weren't allowed to be drunk, in other words.
Oh, no. They were... A lot of them lost their job, kind of, but he wasn't on duty. He hadn't been signed up. You have to be on duty to lose your job. Violation of Rule G. Oh, he used to get a lot of them get fired. They'd stay off a long time before we take them back. But that would be the Keeley cure. You send to people over to Keeley at Greensboro, give them the Keeley cure.
And what's the Keeley cure?
That was detoxification. Drying them out. They call them drying them out this day and time, but those were something like a nursing home. It worked well and get them to straighten them out.
What was your next job for the railroad?
Well, I was promoted to night clerk in the latter part of 1906. And I hadn't paid on a salary, and I hadn't had any. If you're supposed to have a vacation, a week's vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it never did give me in because didn't have anybody to put in place. But the Jamestown Exposition was at Norfolk, Naval Operating Base is located now. The Exposition Ground, that's where the Exposition Grounds were. And I told them I had to go to see that exposition. I'd maybe never see it now in my lifetime. That was in 1907. Well, they put on a special train from Atlanta to Jamestown. They called it Jamestown Special. It ran from Atlanta to Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had two regular trains from Danville to Norfolk. One in the morning and one at night.
So you ended up going to that Jamestown Exposition?
Yeah, I went there in 1907. Spent a week in Norfolk. Stopped at Al Gwynn's in the hotel. $1 a night.
Hmm.
And a room like that cost you about $35 or $40 a night now.
That was a nice place then.
Oh, it was a nice place. But that's all been changed now. I think it's called the Robert Lee Hotel. It was built up around that. The architecture of the building doesn't have the appearance it had the last time I was in Norfolk, that when I was there in 1907.
What did you see at that exposition?
Well, they had quite a good exhibit there. The Southern Railroad had an exhibit there. Norfolk Western had one. I remember they had built a tower out of blocks of coal. That thing went up in the air, I reckon about 40, 50 feet up in the air.
A tower.
To represent a lighthouse, you know, built out of solid blocks of coal, mined for that purpose. To build it. That's quite a feat they had to build those. Of course, they had to see them in the box together. Some of them mm-hmm. 8 and 10 feet long, and at least 4 to 5 feet in thickness. And that's built up right straight up, built up to represent the lighthouse.
Is that something that you could go inside?
No, I don't think it. I think it's built up solid. I don't remember going inside of it. I remember mm-hmm. going in several buildings there. The Miller Brothers show was there. They took over from Cody, William Cody.
Mm-hmm. Annie Oakley and all those?
Yeah, Annie Oakley. Annie Oakley was... In the record, we had just north of Linwood, the old Linwood station. Buffalo Bill, they called him. But the Miller Brothers took that over because Buffalo Bill lost all his best horses in that wreck at Linwood. That in 1903, that's my recollection.
So that was before you were working for the railroad?
Yeah, before I was working for the railroad, 1903. Like that, but people woke up next morning, there were elephants and giraffes and different animals were walking around on the farm, and they didn't know what had happened. Direct, the head-in collision. The engineer had orders to stay at Lexington. There's two show trains passed. Well, the first man passed, and he pulled out. I reckon he thought that was the last section. And he had a head-end collision there and killed all of Buffalo Bill's horses. And Buffalo Bill had a 44 about that long. He came around his hand looking for the engineer. Disobeyed his orders. He's going to kill him. Yeah. But that engineer walked all the way from Linwood back to Spencer. Well, that's the record. He wasn't injured. I guess he only had those oil lights. You couldn't see more than 30 or 40 feet in front of you, those old oil lights. He escaped injury. He might have got bruised up
mm-hmm.
jumping off.
When
Annie Oakley was, she was in a sleeping car. In the train, they had these converted sleeping cars. In the show train.
Mm-hmm.
And she had dark hair. And she woke up the next morning, daylight, and her hair done turned gray.
Really?
Overnight. I guess the experience, very traumatic experience, I assume, that wreck and all the commotion, everything involved with the wreck. And the dying horses neighing and hollering, the animals squealing going on. I guess it was a very ghastly experience because mm-hmm. the head turned white.
Did you get on out to the side of the wreck? Did you ever
no,
go look at
I
it?
No, I didn't go. I didn't have a way of getting over there. But I saw an engine going back over. They would let me get on. I changed some of the officials over there.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a boy then, wearing these breeches.
Everybody pretty excited about that wreck here in
Spencer? Oh, yes. It caused quite a lot of excitement. It Well, they just broke up Buffalo Bill's circus head. That's why the Miller brothers took over, and they had concession there in Jamestown acquisition. Well, I think the story of organization of the Southern Railroad is very exciting. Say Samuel Spencer organized in 1894. Mm-hmm. They got that line from Washington to Orange, and Orange and Alexander, and then the Virginia Midland Railroad, and then they got control of the Richmond Dan Railroad, which ran from Richmond to Danville. Then they acquired from the state of North Carolina from Danville to Greensboro, and they were operating it, but they went into bankruptcy. Then they operated the line from Goldsboro to Charlotte, and they had the shops at Burlington. That's why my father employed. He went to work there in 1880.
So your father worked for the railroad also?
Yeah, Richmond Danville Railroad. Then they moved shop from Burlington to Spencer in 1896. The old buildings were completed in October 1896. And we came here in February 1897. And they only moved to East Spencer, lived on Boxcar Road up from springtime. And
what's Boxcar Road?
That was two large two-story houses and a string of five-room houses. And it was stretched out like a freight train. They called it Boxcar Road.
Is any of that
four
still?
And five-room houses were built pretty close together there on 50-foot lots. But they all caught on fire one night. That's where they had fire protection, burnt the whole thing up. But my father got acquainted with Dr. Whitehead. I think he'd received an injury there. Dr. Whitehead was a competent doctor, and he treated him. And he told me he'd bought a farm where Spencer is now, and he had a farmhouse there, I'd be glad to rent it to him. So he rented this house, I think, about $5 a month. It's a log house, and it had clapboard siding on the side of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lean-to built to it. That wasn't built out of logs, that just built out of siding.
So you lived there too, right?
Yeah, we lived there until they began to build houses in Spencer.
Maybe we'd better start off, from the beginning of that story of reorganization.
Yeah, well, it's organized with Samuel Spencer. We got a lot of short line railroads. Brought them in on the line now. Say, for instance, from the main line from Washington to Atlanta, that's made up of various segments of different railroads. Part of it was North Carolina Railroad from Greensboro to Charlotte. And from Charlotte to Atlanta was the Piedmont Airline Railroad.
The Piedmont what?
Piedmont Airline. That's what they called the airline there. They called the Airline Junction there at Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And then they got control of the line from Charlotte to Augusta. That was the Charlotte CCNA, Charlotte, Columbia, and Augusta Railroad.
Was Mr. Spencer just a real businessman, or did he?
He was a civil engineer. He graduated from Georgia University. During the Civil War, he was in the Georgia Cavalry, after the war was over with, he went back to college and finished his course in civil engineering. And he got connected with J.P. Morgan, the big financiers. And he got control of the East Tennessee, Virginia, and Georgia Railroad and brought that in on the Southern. At ETV and G, from Knoxville to Atlanta, and then Knoxville to Morristown, Tennessee, Bristol, Tennessee, by connection with Northwestern.
When did he start building Spencer? The Spencer shops.
That was started in 1896. They were looking for a central point between Washington line, and they decided they'd build it over at Knoxville. That'd be, they got a line there. North Carolina Midland Railroad runs from Charlotte to Winston-Salem, and then from Winston-Salem to Greensboro, and then from Greensboro to Danville. But they put the shops in the central line. But Henderson's in Rohan County, they had a lot of political influence, and they persuaded them to put it in Salisbury, or close to Salisbury. So they thought it meant a whole lot to Rohan County. They bought the land, bought a farm there while the shop is now, and bought it from a colored man named Petit.
Petit.
P-O-T-E-A-T. And I guess it was for a song. Then Georgia's Land Company has a Southern Railroad subsidiary. They bought up a lot of land around the shop there from the Henderson estate. The Henderson's had a great lot of influence. Well, there's one of them, I think he did, though. One used to be at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was a professor in that. I guess you...
Is that a Henderson that Hendersonville is named after?
No, that's a different set of Hendersons.
How old? So where were you living when they started building the shops?
We were living in Burlington. And they moved the shop from Burlington to Spencer. And they opened up in 1896. And the terminal was from Danville to Charlotte on the Richmond-Danville Railroad. And they changed the terminal from Spencer to Monroe, Virginia. From Monroe to Alexandria, Virginia. And south of here, they extended from Charlotte to Greenville, South Carolina. It used to be another division in there from Charlotte to Central South Carolina. That gave them a direct line between Atlanta with the connection to the South, and then they got the control railroad from East Tennessee, Virginia, Georgia, from Atlanta to Knoxville to Bristol. And they got control of the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, runs from Memphis and Charleston. That comes in from Memphis and into Chattanooga. Of course, it connects with ETV and G, and on into Asheville, and Asheville on into Columbia, and then on all the way to Charleston. And that gave them line. They got CNO and DP Railroad. That's the line zone for the city of Cincinnati. That's the Cincinnati, New Orleans, and Texas Pacific Railroad. The city of Cincinnati owned that line from Cincinnati to Chattanooga. They got a passing train running from Cincinnati to Charleston, South Carolina. Cincinnati to Goldsboro, North Carolina.
When you were working for the railroads, did you get a chance to ride the trains?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I did most all my traveling the trains.
Where would you usually go?
Well, we went to different places. had Free Time Station. We had a sleeping car run from Charlotte to Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
Come home pretty tired out late on Friday afternoon. I said, honey, let's go to the beach tonight. She said, oh, I'd go. All I got to do is throw in an extra dress in my bag and I'll be ready to go. We'd have supper and go down the railroad station. There'd be a car and I'd go into Norfolk. Go to bed and I'd take the upper berth and give her a lower berth. Wake up next morning, Saturday morning, we'd be in Norfolk, and then we'd go out to Virginia Beach and spend Saturday and Sunday, and leave at Norfolk Sunday night, get in here and down and go to work Monday morning.
It's nice having that free ride.
Well, it all cost me my Pullman fare.
Uh-huh.
And we had a Pullman car from Salt Lake to Asheville. And we had a Pullman car to Richmond. One to Goldsboro.
You ever go out to Hot Springs?
Hot Springs, Arkansas?
No, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, I've been there through Hot Springs on the train. Then I've been through there in the car. I never did stop there, though. It used to be a very popular resort. I don't know, looked like it fell to the wayside for some reason.
Yeah, I was up there this past summer. And
they say
there's nothing there now.
Good water there. That water's warm when it comes out of the ground there, isn't it?
Well, it's all closed. The springs are closed up now.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I hear it's politics, but it's hard to say. So
they had some on the main line of the Southern Railroad between Asheville and Knoxville.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the jobs that you had working for the railroad. Before we were talking.
Yeah, well,
you were call boy first.
Call boy, and then I was promoted to night clerk. Then in 1909, I was promoted to daylight clerk. That paid $5 more than a month.
What sort of things did you have to do for your job? What were your duties?
Well, that was roundhouse work, keeping record of the locomotives. And record the crews.
Mm-hmm.
General office work, write requisitions for material. Then I worked that till 1922.
That was about 10 years or so, right?
I worked from about 1909 out of 1922 in the roundhouse, and then I went to the Boiler Inspection Bureau. I had charge of the boiler inspection of all steam locomotives. We had to make reports to the government on those locomotives. Each one had to be inspected every month. My responsibility was to see that engine inspected on the date is due, like it went on the 1st or 12th of the month or 15th, whatever day it would be.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't...
If it wasn't inspected on that date, I was supposed to notify the superior officer and he would order that engine out of service and be brought in for inspection. And they had to make a monthly inspection of it. Then they had to make a quarterly inspection of it. Then they had to make a yearly inspection of it. And had to review all the flues every 4 years. And every 5 years they had to remove all the lagging and the jacket from the locomotive to make exterior inspection where it was covered up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to keep those records in mind and keep those dates up. That was when the federal Boiler Inspection Law went into effect. It was designed to curtail explosions and accidents to the employees. Certain safety standards were prescribed and had to live up to the laws governing those, each part of the locomotive, each inspection part.
Did
I helped this man make his part of the work, and he'd have to give swear in under oath that he did the work best of his knowledge and belief. Couldn't shirk his work, didn't. They wouldn't persecute him, not doing the work, and prosecute him for perjury, because he swore he didn't, and he didn't. As far as I know, all the time that I worked there from 1922 to 1939, I can't recall ever having an accident or anybody ever being injured as a result of improper inspection. So like I say, they had torn the Notre Republic, and they had taken an obligation to me if they'd done the work properly. I believe they were truthful men, and they wouldn't swear to a lie unless they had done it. They're very conscientious, you know. They wanted to do the right thing.
That's good.
As far as I know, we never had a serious. Prior to that time, we had these boiler explosions and the same like that. The gauge cocks get sucked up. The water glass would be defective. And the engineer couldn't tell whether what the water level had. You know, it might be out of water, and that crown sheet would get hot, and he'd pull his injector on that cold water rushing in on that hot crown sheet, bound the gear, something to gear, you see. And his gauge cock may be stopped up, but he couldn't tell. It just his gauge cock, he couldn't see any water coming out. He was supposed to put it in the to keep that crown sheet cold with the cold water all the time. Of course, then that crown sheet had to be hot to generate steam and operate your locomotive.
It's the crown sheet, did you say? Crown?
Crown. C-R-O-W-N.
What exactly?
Well, that is over the firebox. The firebox is huge, pretty huge, you know. They pile coal in to get that empty, you know. Then the smoke and things go out through the boiler tubes into the front, come out the smokestack, where the smoke came from. The tubes that heated the water. And the crown sheet that was supposed to be covered with water all the time. If it didn't, put cold water on it and blow that crown sheet down. That'd kill everybody on the locomotive, everybody around there. It was an explosion.
Did that ever happen?
Oh, yes. They frequently had those. So I went on this job. They had one on the washing division. Killed several people. Found out that didn't the proper work to it, you see.
So you were keeping books and stuff on.
Oh yeah, I had to keep the book on, and then I had they'd write out a form, put one of them in the cab, and give me a copy of it for my records, and I'd recopy that, and I'd send the Oil Inspection Bureau, the Interstate Commerce Commission, in Washington, the top copy of it, and then the next copy go to Washington. I kept the file in the office all the time.
So they already have the forms all printed up and stuff with you?
Yeah, prescribed forms. And each item had to be answered yes or no, you know, if it was safe or unsafe. They setting the pop valves on the locomotive. That's pretty important, you know. You got to know what you're doing. You set those pop valves, go off at a certain pressure if you don't know what to. But you're doing that, you better not fool with it. Yeah. Same way, inspection there, you get under the engine there and look up under there and see what's wrong, anything's wrong. And the stay bolt, you find one of them leaking, you're supposed to take that stay bolt out. That's connecting the inner sheets, you see, the outer sheet, the inner sheet, or the water, and then that stay bolt begin to leak something, you're supposed to take that stay bolt out.
Were you living at home when you started working for the railroad? Were you living at your parents' home?
Yeah, I lived with my parents when I started working.
When did you move out?
Well, I got married in 1918. I got housekeeping for myself.
When you were living at home, did you give your parents part of your paycheck? Did you have to?
Oh, yeah, sure. We had four brothers on that was, and two sisters.
Younger, all younger than you?
All younger than I was.
You had to help.
Contributed to support of course. Of course, it wasn't making so much, but a little money in those days would go a long ways. I'd give them a check to my mother, you know, from the room and board. When I was making $25 a month, I got making $40 a month. That's when I went to Jamestown Exposition.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was a millionaire. Then I got the daylight job. I paid $50 a month. That was $600 a year.
Was that a lot of money back then?
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of money back then. And I made most of my work was $50 a month.
Was
and, 1939, I left the Board Inspection Bureau and went to the car shop, the chief clerk for General Car Company. Much higher salary than what I was making in the Board Inspection Bureau.
Were you making
$7.40 a day then? $8 work.
Was that like more or less than the,
9 cents
the people?
An hour. Oh, yeah, that was the highest rate they had. 9 cents an hour.
So you were making more than the actual people that were working on the
yeah,
repairs?
They were making 85 cents an hour. And Carmen was making 78 cents an hour when I went in 1939. I worked for, in that 1957 when I retired in 1957. But I was making 9 cents an hour. I was 7 20 a day. I thought I was a millionaire. Never made any money before that time, but it took about all the years. I paid my home, you know, and I was making $150 a month.
What kinds of, what was your normal daily routine when you first started working for the railroad as a call boy? What time did you have to get up?
Oh, I had to go to work at 7 o'clock at night. I have to get up at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. That daylight sleeping takes, it doesn't do you, 10 hours wouldn't do you much good as 5 hours of nighttime sleeping. You got to sleep all day. Go to bed as soon as you get home, get off at 7 in the morning, go to bed, get to bed, eat breakfast, go to bed about 8, get up at 6 in the afternoon, go to work at 7.
And you'd walk to work?
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't, no, walk to work, walk home. There wasn't any telephones, no electric lights. I'd carry them in and call the engine crews.
You ride a horse at all on your job, or
oh,
just
no.
Walking?
Oh, just walking. Walk all night long. And I'd walk the office. Well, we got another crew. Once you get, go so-and-so direction, call the engineer and somebody to call the fireman. There's two of us. We take one section down, the other section down. Yeah, remember when I first went to work, railroad now, we had some engines in service and been used during the Civil War. But all those are gone now. I always like those old.
What happens to engines after they stop being used?
Oh, they sold the scrap. World War One, we sold a lot of 16, 17-inch cylinder engines to Japan. They'd been stored at that shop for a long, long time. And sold in Japan. I remember the old men over there said, boys, you better mind out what you're doing. Them Japanese will be shooting those engines back to you, which they did, you know, in World War Two. Shooting back to us. Sounds pretty good. You could buy it. Price to have was about a cent and a half a pound for steel and malleable. But you could buy scrap glass for 5 or 6 cents a pound. You know what it's selling for today?
A lot more than that.
$2.50 a pound. We had a lot of wooden coaches on the railroad. And then built during the Victorian period. They had a lot of embellishments,
mm-hmm.
fancy brass, with oil lights and baggage racks.
Did they have any of those still riding the rails when,
oh,
when
yeah,
you were working?
Oh, yeah, open platform cars, they call them. I remember when I was just a child, they said the vestibule was coming through as a train from Greensboro to Goldsboro. So go down, we live just about two blocks from where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
Go down and see the vestibule come by. All, prior to that time, all the cars were open platform cars, but the vestibule cars were enclosed.
Mm.
Like the other day, you never see a open platform car less. The last time they went out of style during World War One. I don't think it was any in service in World War II.
There was
some in service in 1933. Because I went to Chicago to see the World Fair in 1933. And talking to one of the trainmen on the Big Four Railroad, he said that we use any kind of equipment to get so many people going to the fair. And the car I was riding in was an open-end car, open platform.
That means it didn't have a roof or anything, or?
Oh, yeah, it had a roof on it, but just a platform to walk off the roof. Like this, the end of the car, the roof, it could extend out that far. And just a platform there. Nothing to keep it from falling out. And then you cross between the cars. The first soldier in the Civil War killed, he was on the West Point Railroad between Richmond and West Point, Virginia. He's on the train. He started to go from one coach to another. He's opening cars. And he fell, and the train ran over. He fell down the track, and the train ran over. That was the first Confederate soldier who was killed, according to the records.
Wasn't even in battle, huh?
Oh, no. But it was dangerous there. Them cars lighting on it, rocking too, you know. If I get over bounds, it was dangerous to go between them one car. Now they close up, I don't know. Well, it wasn't the doors there, you wouldn't know.
Hmm.
This is opening up, you see. Those platform cars, they have them, they can run up to the station while the platform. You don't even have to go down the steps. You just walk right off the inside of the car, right on the platform on the railroad, and have a ramp.
When you started working for the railroads then, what kind of people were riding the railroads? Was it rich people or anybody?
Well,
everybody?
Most of the people had to have money, you know, to ride the railroads.
What are
unusual.
What would it cost?
We'd go down, well, I think it was around about 2 cents a mile. Yet, on the other hand, they had special rates. The advertising, you get some old railroad advertising, you know. Go to California, you know, for less than $50. Get settlers to come out there, you know, off of those rates. And some of those Canadian railroads were still making that offer up here a few years back. They had what they call immigration cars. People come from Europe or they want to immigrate. And they had on the side of the car immigration cars. All long distance, that $25 or $30 for 1,000 miles. Now, you used to go from here to Washington for about 2.5-3 cents a mile. That's about 332 miles. It's be about $6-7.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's $25 riding same Washington Salisbury.
Yeah.
25. They were farmers, well-to-do farmers, merchants, and traveling salesmen. A lot of them used the railroads. Well, that's before we had the highways. You know. And ship the goods.
Did you ever have much contact with the people, or
the passengers?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't personally come in contact with them, but you go to the railroad station, you see, they have a telegraph operator there, and they have an agent there. And they ship a lot of less than carload of stuff from those. They have a car, say, going from Greensboro to Raleigh. And they load that stuff, they peddle it out, and say, stop at Elon College, and Burlington, Graham, Hall River, Hillsborough, there, be something in there, and they load that out of that car. That car's going to, finally gets Raleigh. Wouldn't be anything after Raleigh. Of course, they pick up stuff going that direction. Maybe from Raleigh, transferred to Seaboard. Seaboard Airline at Raleigh. Go to Richmond. That's where you used to go to Richmond, around Raleigh. As 6th North Carolina Regiment, that's the regiment I was connected with. The original regiment trained there at the old company shops at Burlington. Of course, it was called company shops at that time. And Colonel Fisher's buried right up here in the old Lutheran Cemetery, right this side of the, right this side of the station at Salisbury. Just got a little small marker there. There's a larger monument there for his daughter, but his marker's small, but a little bit larger than your machine there.